Okay, so today what we're going to be talking about is part two of Sundar Singh's story. Yeah. So that was a story we started probably a month ago. So I'm going to give you a bit of an overview to refresh your memory because we're sort of starting where I finished off last time. So Sundar Singh, if you remember, he was born into a very devout Sikh family. So Sikhism is a brand of Hinduism or a branch of Hinduism. And his family were quite wealthy, and he was brought up, particularly by his mother, to be a very devout Sikh. And he lived in the northern part of India in a small town. And there he first encountered Christianity when he went to school. And he hated it. And because he felt that Christianity was a foreign religion that didn't belong in India. India was a proud Hindu country, and it was for the Hindus and for the Sikhs and so on. So he really resented the idea that he had to be exposed to Christianity. Christianity also belonged to the lowest class, and in India there was a very strict caste system where if you were born in the upper classes, that's where you stayed. And if you're in the lower classes, well, you had no hope of climbing up the social ladder. So Sundar looked at these Christians. They were low class. That he called them the sweepers, the street sweepers. And pretty much he had a very low opinion of these people. And then we talked about how at the age of 14, he suffered two very traumatic events in his life. He lost his mother and his older brother within the space of 2 months. And this event shook the foundations of all his beliefs. He had believed very clearly that, you know, that the world was about karma. You know, you do good and good happens to you. He believed in all of these types of things. And the death of his mother particularly really shook those foundations. And he started to question many things. And it came to a point where he actually decided that he would commit suicide. And 1 hour before he committed suicide, the Lord Jesus revealed himself to him in a vision and dramatically changed this young boy's life. So he was converted, but for a Sikh, this was a terrible thing. You know, if you were born a Sikh, you died a Sikh. You never, ever converted. And to convert was to put shame on your whole family name for generations on. And so his family were really, really angry with what he'd done and persecuted him very severely and attempted to kill him twice. So as a 16-year-old, this was a very, very difficult part of his life. He had to escape. He went and stayed with some missionaries in a town called Simla, and there he was baptized. And at the age of 16, he had to decide what he wanted to do with his life. And he decided to take on the robes of a sadhu. Now, a sadhu, if you remember, is a holy man, not necessarily connected to any religion, but a holy man is someone who has renounced modern life. They don't have a home, they don't have any material possessions, and they travel from place to place. Now, a Hindu sadhu might travel from, you know, temple to temple and, you know, pilgrim, sort of like a pilgrimage. But he wanted to be a Christian sadhu, a man that travelled from town to town spreading the gospel without a home, without any form of possessions other than his New Testament. And so that's what he did. He took on the saffron robes of a sadhu, and as an Indian, he decided to go to his own people to spread the gospel. And that's where we'll start our story today. So at the age of 16, he decided that he would travel through the northern part of India. You see, the north of India was very much closed to the gospel. It was seen as the sort of the foothold of the Hindus. And it was very different to the south of India. There was a very distinct divide there, even today. And so he wanted to go from village to village and to tell people of the good news. And he really took the Lord's words in the New Testament very seriously. When the Lord sent out his disciples and said to them, you know, don't go with anything. You just go from one village to another. And if they don't accept you, shake the dust off your feet and continue on. And that's pretty much how he lived. So he went from one village to another, spreading the gospel. You see, with the robes of a sadhu, he was accepted. People, because of the sort of the Indian connection, people saw that he was a holy man. And when he came into the marketplaces and he spoke to people, people kind of gathered to listen. And at first, people used to think that he was speaking of another Hindu god. You know, they had so many. And so they would listen and they would consider what he said. But soon, when they realized that he was speaking of Christianity, that's when trouble arose. And that's when he was often thrown out of villages, chased out. You know, he had stones thrown at him and so on. And then he would move on to another village. One time he was in a village and he was speaking and nobody wanted to give him anything and they didn't want to listen to him. And so he had nowhere to go that night. And he found a sort of an abandoned hut on the edge of the village and he decided that he would just sleep there. And so he was so tired, he lay down and with a blanket, which was his only thing that he carried with him, he covered himself with the blanket and fell asleep. And in the early hours of the morning when he awoke, he saw this kind of like dark form next to him. He didn't know what it was, but he tried to sort of take his blanket and it was stuck under something. And as his eyes adjusted, he looked at this thing right next to him and he realized it was a huge cobra coiled up on his blanket right next to him. And of course, he jumped up and ran out of the hut. And so this was a deadly snake, if you know anything about snakes. But then he stood outside the hut thinking about his blanket. You know, without his blanket, he would not be able to survive. It was pretty cold in northern India. And so he prayed and he asked the Lord for protection. And he walked in and he said, "Lord, please keep this snake asleep." And so he got his blanket and he sort of pulled and this big cobra just rolled off the blanket and just continued sleeping. So he got his blanket. And if you know anything about cobras, that is very, very uncharacteristic of this aggressive snake. So that was one of many examples of times when the Lord provided for him throughout these trips that he had across the northern part of India. And he met many people there as well. He met and he had companions along the way. There was one time, though, when he went back to his hometown. And there in his hometown, he was actually very, very apprehensive because he knew people would recognize him. And he hadn't been back for a few years now. So when he went into the town, you know, people did recognize him, but he was surprised because many of them, you know, the people in the marketplaces, the stall holders and so on who recognized him, they actually were really interested in what he had to say. They saw that he'd taken on the robes of a sadhu. They saw that he was a Christian. They knew that. And so they were interested in his message. And he managed to be able to speak to the people in his own village. However, when his father saw him, it was a very different situation. His father, he could see that his father was holding back any sort of sign of recognition. And he knew very clearly that his family had completely disowned him. But his father did motion to him and said that he could sleep under their roof for that night if he came after nightfall and left before dawn. And so, you know, Sundar was very grateful for this and he went back to his family home. But he soon realized that he was being treated like one of the untouchables. So in India, you know, these were the lowest people. And he knew that because when he came and his father motioned for the servants to get him something to eat, he wasn't given a plate or a cup. He had to hold out his hands because in India, if you are of the lowest of the low class, nobody would give you a cup lest you defile it. And so Sundar realized that he, as the son of this in this home, was now being treated as an untouchable. And he had to sort of cup his hands to eat the food and drink the water. And he couldn't stay there. He was so saddened by the fact that he'd been so completely disowned by his family and treated as a sort of something that you would sort of just sweep aside, that he ended up not staying there and he ran away. He thanked his father, ran away and slept in the open. Now, for 3 years, he traveled around and he encountered a lot of difficulty. You know, he hungered, he had a lot of thirst, he was footsore and weary. Sometimes he had food, sometimes he didn't. He learnt to eat fruit on the way when he passed a tree. He learnt to eat roots and things when nobody would give him food. And by the time he was 19, he'd travelled through many, many villages and encountered a lot of difficulty. But his heart was always for Tibet. And he really, really wanted to go there. Even as a 16-year-old, he had stood on the mountains and looked across to the Himalayas. And Tibet was a formidable country at this time, which is the early 1900s. It was a very closed-off country, both physically and spiritually. So Tibet, if you know where it is, it's in the Himalayas. And it borders China on one side and you've got India on the other. And firstly, it was closed very much physically, because from India there were only certain months of the year that you could pass through into Tibet. There were these places which are still there today called the mountain passes. And there are certain passes that you can travel, and they were very, very difficult routes to walk, very dangerous. You often had to cross rivers, there were precipices. It was all through the Himalayas. And of course, the altitude was really high as well. So for most people, it was an impossible task to hike through these mountain passes. And only during the summer months was it open, because the snow was so great during the winter time that you just simply couldn't get through. And at this particular time of the year, so around April, Sundar would see the traders from Tibet coming out and coming into India to sell their goods. And every time he saw them, you know, he saw these people who were really tough mountain people, but they were highly superstitious, because Tibet was a Buddhist country. It had its own version of Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism. And it was ruled very strongly by the Dalai Lama, who was like the king or almost a deity in the Tibetan culture. And it was very much a superstitious country. And these traders, when Sundar saw them, you know, they would often be holding what like rosary beads and chanting each sort of for each bead. And when they were engaged in business, they would twirl these prayer wheels. And the prayers, the idea was the prayers would keep flowing even while your mind is involved in something else. So they were very, very superstitious people, very much tied to their Buddhist faith. And Sundar could see that it was a very closed country spiritually as well. He didn't know this, but prior to the 1900s, people had attempted to bring the gospel to the Tibetan people. So actually there was the Chinese Inland Mission, which was Hudson Taylor's sort of mission. They tried to send some missionaries from the Chinese border into Tibet, and they hadn't been able to do it. Many people had died in Tibet, and very little impact had been made for the gospel. There was also a Canadian missionary who was, had a real, something strong on her heart to actually go into Tibet. And her and her Dutch husband and her young son decided finally, after a lot of preparation, to make the journey and try and travel into Tibet and spread the gospel. And after a short while, she returned alone, because her husband and her young son had died in Tibet, and she was a very broken woman after that. You know, she felt that the whole venture had resulted in nothing except the death of her husband and her child, and there'd been no sort of result of that. However, there was, because many people were starting to be quite interested in this country and try and work out a way of bringing the gospel to Tibet. One of the early writers wrote that if the enemy of all good could choose a seat for his empire, he would choose Tibet. And that's what people felt about this country. It was so resistant to the gospel. Now, Sundar didn't know all of this detail at the time. He didn't know about the people who died there, the people who'd attempted to get into Tibet. He knew nothing, but he knew, and the Lord put it very strongly on his heart, that he needed to go. And so he decided that one year, when he was 19 years old, he decided to make the journey. And he noticed when the traders were coming through, because that was a sign that the mountain passes were open, and he made the journey into Tibet. And he came sort of to the border, and there on the borders were some European missionaries. They'd sort of set up something, and they were trying to learn the language and the culture of the Tibetan people. And with them were a couple of young local Tibetans who'd just become Christians. And so Sunda stayed with them to try and learn the language and the culture of the Tibetan people. And after a while, he travelled with a young local man, and together, the two of them, both quite young, travelled through the mountain passes to try and get into Tibet. And they did manage to do it, but for this first trip, it was very difficult for Sunda. Not only was there a language difficulty, but he was shocked by the culture. One thing, one basic thing was, he could not cope with the smell of the people. You see, in Tibet and in the villages, the people, it was so cold up there that they never washed. And instead of washing, they would rub rancid butter, like rotten butter, all over their skin to keep them warm from the cold. And so the smell of body odour mixed with off butter, and having people who just never washed, their grimy, grimy faces, he couldn't cope. He actually would be nauseated when he was amongst these people. So that was one of the first things he encountered. Another thing he encountered was the food. The food was so difficult to stomach. When they drank tea, they piled in salt, not sugar, and they even mixed in yak butter. So this was the tea. Now, if you know anything about Indians, they love their tea, their chai. And the idea of this tea, again, he could hardly stomach it. And the other thing, they ate this porridge, which was made out of fermented barley, which was ground down into a fine flour. And they mixed in rancid butter and the tea to make the sort of like a paste that looked like glue. And that was the main meal of the Tibetan people, particularly in the villages. And all this kind of food was very practical food for the harsh winters and the fact that they could hardly grow anything in the landscape. But it was very difficult for Sunda to even stomach. So there was that. Of course, the language was an issue as well. And he also found that the people, particularly in the villages, were so controlled by the priests who were known as the lamas. We had the Dalai Lama, who was the head, and then in all the villages there was a lama who was like the sort of the head of that particular village. Like they were like priests. And they were very controlling and put into the people a great fear of anything foreign. And so when Sunda came into villages and he spoke, and the priests would warn the people that this man is trying to take you away from the Tibetan traditions and culture, you know, don't listen to him. And again, you know, he found it was very difficult to spread the gospel amongst these people. However, he had some very good times, and there was times when he sat down with these priests and they discussed things very intently. And for many people, it was the very, very first time they'd ever heard of the Bible or even the man called Jesus. This first trip only lasted a few weeks, so it was an introduction to Tibet, and it kindled in him the desire that he would be going back, and he would definitely try to get further into Tibet, into the mountain ranges and into the very remote villages where people had never heard of the gospel. And so the pattern of his life for the next 6 or 7 years was that he would travel through the villages of northern India. He would go back to Simla, and where the place was where he stayed with the missionaries, and he would volunteer there and help with the people with leprosy. But then the minute the traders came, indicating that the mountain passes were open, every year he would go back to Tibet and spend many months there travelling around, bringing the gospel to the villages. Now, I can't tell you all the events that occurred to him on these trips. There are a lot. But I'll tell you a few incidents that happened on the way. There was one time when he was walking in the foothills of the Himalayas mountains, and along this path he was walking along, and he just had, as usual, his blanket and his robes and so on, and a man approached him, and this man was in tears and he was crying and he was shaking, and Sunda was like, what's happened? And the man said, "Oh, please, can you help? You see, my friend..." And he pointed to the distance and there was a crumpled figure on the road. He said, "My friend, he's dead. He died. He's just died, and I have nothing. I have no money. I have nothing. I can't even bury him." And Sundar was full of compassion and said, "You know, well, I don't have much, but I do have these two coins." He'd been given some coins from the last village he went to by someone who was sympathetic. He was going to use it for food, but he thought this person would need it more. So he gave him the two coins and said, "Here, and take my blanket." And the man thanked him and went on his way. And Sundar continued down the road, down a different road. Then probably about half an hour later, he heard footsteps behind him. And he turned, and it was this same man running after him. And this man now was pale and white. And he came to Sundar, and he threw down the blanket and the coins and said, "My friend is dead." And Sundar said, "You just told me that. I just saw you on the road. You just told me." And the man said, no, he's really dead." You see, what had happened was this man and his friend had been tricking travellers for many months. They had been on the roadside, and one of them would play dead, would lie on the road, and the other one would pretend to cry and shake and beg people, and that way they'd fleeced so many travellers of money, of all sorts of things, and they would split it and then do the same thing on another road. They'd been doing this for ages, and now, when this friend had returned to split the coins and the blanket, he looked, and his friend was actually dead on the road. And so, of course, you know, Sundar, when this man said, "You know, my friend is dead." He really meant that his friend had actually died. And of course, this man said, "You know, I've realized I've tricked a holy man, and now the gods are going to get me next too." And of course, Sundar had a wonderful opening for the gospel that day. And he told the man about his sin and that there was the option of forgiveness in the Lord Jesus. And he traveled with this particular man for a while, and they came to a place where he knew that missionaries were stationed. And he dropped this man off there and he said, "You know, learn some more about this man Jesus." And anyway, we know that this man eventually became baptized and took the gospel back to his homelands, wherever he lived as well. So that was one time, one example of an event that happened. Another was a time when Sundar was travelling between villages in Tibet. And it was, as I said, you know, these mountain passes were tough. And I looked them up even for today, and for modern travellers, that it's, there, you know, there are lots of warnings, and they pretty much say you shouldn't do it unless you've got quite a lot of training. So these particular mountain passes were very, very dangerous. Now, add to that that in the area, sort of in the Himalayan foothills and along these mountain passes, there were many wild animals, which things like leopards and panthers, that did prey on humans. And there were villages where, you know, there'd been many attacks, particularly in the times when food was scarce. And so it was a very sort of dangerous place. And he was between villages at this point. And the sun was already starting to set. It was late afternoon. And he was tired, and he knew, though, that he couldn't stop. You know, if he did stop, then he'd probably still be walking at nightfall, and it was way too dangerous to do that. And so he kept walking, and he tried to keep going despite feeling extremely tired. And he came to a point where there was a river, and the river was swollen and was raging faster than it usually goes. And he was so tired, and he just looked and he thought, "This is impossible. I can't cross this river." And he turned, he couldn't go back. He couldn't go back to the village. He couldn't go on. And he thought, "What am I going to do?" And he actually said, "Lord, you brought me this far only to be eaten by a leopard or something." And he actually sank to his knees and started to cry because he thought, "What am I going to do? I can't cross the river. I can't go back. And I'm just going to be stuck here. And it's already late afternoon. The sun will set. what am I going to do? And just as he was thinking about his options, he saw on the other side of the river there was a fire, and a man was warming himself by the fire. And the man called and said, "Do you want to cross?" And Sunda said, "Well, yes, but I can't cross. The water's raging too quickly and I'll be swept away." And the man said, "Just stay where you are." And then this man walked through the river. And Sunda thought, it must be a local. He must know exactly where to walk, you know, where it doesn't go deep and so on. And it must be incredibly strong to be able to resist the water. And so the man just walked across the river through the raging water and came onto the other side and said, "Hop on my shoulders." And so Sunda climbed up on the man's shoulders, and the man then walked all the way, picking his way across the river to the other side. And Sunda was so shocked but incredibly relieved. And he got off the man's back and he was sort of just straightening his robe, and he turned around and there was no man or fire. And so he thanked the Lord for sending an angel. And on many occasions, these things happened. And so Sunda really strongly believed in angels. And there were many occasions where things happened and people sort of, you know, someone gave him food and he turned to thank them and they were gone. You know, events like that happened. And he knew that the Lord was providing for him at times of need. There was one other occasion in Tibet, and this kind of gives you an idea of the things that he had to go through in Tibet as well. He was in a town by the name of Rasa. And in this particular town, it was very, very resistant to the gospel. And he met with a lot of anger. And of course, he spoke to people in the villages, but then the priest, the Lama, came. And this priest was so angry and said, "How dare you? What are you doing? You are trying to convert my people, these villagers, to a foreign god. I'll not have any of it." And he arrested Sunda, and he decided that Sunda should be executed for his attempt to convert people to Christianity. And so, you know, in the Buddhist tradition, you're not allowed to harm anyone. You're not allowed to take a life. So the way they executed people was horrific. There were two options. The first was they actually got the person and sewed them up in a fresh yak skin. And then they would leave them in the sun. And the sun would dry out the yak skin and gradually crush the person to death. And in that way, they personally weren't taking a life. It was the natural forces that were taking that person's life. And so they wouldn't be charged for that. The second way was they had a great big well outside the town. It was very deep. And they used to throw people in the well and sort of close off the well and lock it. And again, in that way, the person would probably either die from the fall or if not from that, starvation, lack of oxygen, all sorts of other things. And again, it was nature killing the person. And of course, they would be acquitted. So these were the two options. And the second option was chosen for Sunda. And so he was tied up and taken to the well. And then they took him, they got the huge iron lid of the well off, and Sunda was taken and he was thrown into this very deep well that went right under the earth. And when he was thrown in, he broke his arm in the fall. But more than that, when he fell to the bottom, he was just hit by the horrendous smell. He was standing in the rotting flesh of other people, other victims who'd been thrown in. And the smell and the darkness was so much that it was almost crushing him. He heard the iron lid being put on and the locks being attached, and he thought to himself in the absolute pitch darkness that this was it. No one knew where he was. None of his friends. They knew he was in Tibet. They didn't know where. And now he was at the bottom of a well, under the earth, and no one would know that he was there. There was no hope of rescue at all. The smell and the horror of that situation was almost more than he could bear. The pain in his arm was nothing. And after many hours, he actually cried out and said, my God, why have you forsaken me here? And he really did feel that he had been completely and utterly forsaken. And so many, many hours passed. In fact, a day passed and another day, and he was getting weaker and weaker, but he all he could do was stand at the bottom of this horrible well, knowing that around him were the rotting bodies of other people. And on the third day, it was in the morning, and he knew this because he heard a sound at the top, and he heard it was like grating. And then he realized, because there was daylight coming in, that this lid, the iron lid, was being unlocked and being pushed aside. Now, it would have taken a couple of people, it took many people to get the lid on, because it was a really quite a big lid. So he thought there must be people up there. And so, sure enough, he heard a voice. And the voice said, you know, grab onto the rope. And soon a rope was being dropped down. And he thought, what's happening? And a rope came down, and he grabbed onto it, and the voice said, tie it around your waist. And so he tied it around his waist, and with his good arm, he held onto the rope, and someone was just lifting him up out of that well. And as he came up into the daylight, he actually said he felt like a drowning man that had got a first gulp of fresh air, because the air was so horrible in this well. The minute he smelt the fresh air of the morning, it was like he could breathe again. That's what he felt. And he was lifted up, and he sort of collapsed onto the ground. And first thing he realized was that his arm was better, completely better. And he looked up to thank his rescuer, but there was no one. And he looked around, and it was an open area, and there was not a person in sight. And so he realized again that the Lord had sent an angel. And of course, after a few hours, he made his way back into the village. And everyone was so shocked to see him. They just 3 days ago, they'd thrown him in the well. Nobody gets out of that well. You can't climb out, and even if you did manage to climb for some reason, there was no way you could get that iron lid off yourself, even if it wasn't locked. It was just too heavy. But here he was, and there was no doubting who this person was. And of course, again, you know, he was taken before the priest or the lama, and this priest was so angry and said, who let you out? There is only one key to that well. There's only one key, and I have that key. Who has taken it? And Sundar explained what happened. He said, well, I was just in the well. Someone let down a rope, and I was lifted out. And the lama said, this is impossible. There is one key, and it's always on my belt. And he looked on his belt, and there it was. And he thought, what's happening? The priest had always had the key, and it was still with him from that very moment. And the priest became so fearful, and he told Sundar to get out, because he felt like there was some sort of supernatural thing at work, and he was very scared. And so Sundar had no choice but to leave and to go continue on his journey. But that particular incident really stayed with him. And other times when he talked about Tibet, you know, he really was very deeply scarred by that incident, because the memory of that time in the well and feeling that sense of being forsaken was something that stayed with him. And yet, you know, he continued his journey through Tibet. It didn't stop him from going back there, even though the horror of that time stayed with him. And he continued to travel through these towns. Now, by the time he was in his mid-20s, he became quite well known. The reason for that was because during his travels, he also used to write a little column in a missionary newspaper or some sort of newsletter that was circulated. And so people started to read it, people started to get to know who he was, and they started to, you know, to be interested in his stories, particularly because He often wrote about his time in Tibet and all the incidents that had occurred, and people were interested in these things. And so he soon got an invite to go to the south, southern India. And this was quite a big step for him. Firstly, he didn't have the dialect. There were different languages spoken. And so he would need to speak through a translator. And there was a college where there were some students who were studying sort of to become reverends and ministers and so on. And there was a young man there by the name of Vincent David, and he happened to know a few dialects. And so he was selected to be the translator for Sunda as he went to these conferences in southern India. Now, in the south, it was very different. The north was very resistant to Christianity. It was the proud Hindu capital of India. But in the south, there had been a Christian tradition for a long time. You see, there was a tradition that Thomas, the disciple of Jesus, had actually travelled to India, to the south of India, and had actually brought Christianity there in the early times, in the early Christian church era. And so there were, you know, there were memorials, there were shrines and all sorts of things to Thomas. And Christianity had sort of a hold in southern India more than the north. So this was a very, very different situation for Sunda. He had experienced great persecution in Tibet and even in the towns of northern India. But here in the south, things were quite different. So with this young man by the name of Vincent David, together they travelled and they started speaking. He started speaking and Vincent would translate. And he went from conference to conference, and soon, you know, people were asking him to speak, sometimes three times a day. And there were occasions, I think, there was a big conference, and the Indians do things on a very big scale. And this conference, on the very last day, 32,000 people gathered to hear him speak. And Vincent David was a very young and energetic uni student, and he was struggling to keep up. It was so grueling, you know, speaking, the concentration he needed to translate, the hours and hours, the travel, there was no break, and he was really tired and really struggling. And Sunda would pray with him and just ask the Lord to give him strength. And Vincent would look at Sunda and think, how are you doing it? You know, I'm just translating. You're the one speaking. And Vincent was really struggling. There was a time when Vincent, they were asleep in a house. They were staying with friends. Vincent was on the veranda sleeping, and Sunda was in an adjoining room. And Vincent woke up in the night because he heard slithering. And he heard a snake. And he was wondering, did the snake go in or was it coming out? And so he couldn't sleep. He jumped up and he got a lantern and he sort of looked around his room and he thought, there's nothing here. And so he tiptoed into Sunda's room because he thought, oh my goodness, has it gone into his room? So he got the lantern and he tiptoed into the room. And when he looked into the room, he saw Sunda not in his bed, but sat cross-legged on the floor praying. And he thought, what? With this schedule we have is so tough, and here you are in the middle of the night, you're praying. Anyway, there was no snake there, so he came out and he wondered about that. And in the morning, he said to Sunda, how do you do it? You know, I can hardly keep up, and you stay up half the night praying? And Sunda said, you know, there's no time during the day, and with what we have to do, of course I need to pray. And prayer comes before sleep. And he used to say that in praying, it was also like sleep. It was also like rest, because what he felt like he was doing, Sunda described it as taking his hands and putting them into the hands of the Lord. And that's what he felt prayer was all about. Now, there were many incidents that occurred in the south as well. And to give you an idea of some of the things that occurred, there was one time that Sunda was staying with another family that put him up. And this place was in a country area. So it was sort of a bit of a wilderness kind of place. And in that particular village, there had been leopard attacks. And there was a leopard that sort of kept coming back. And so on that particular night, there were people who were out hunting for this leopard to kill it, because, you know, it was coming back all the time and it had killed, there were many fatalities as well. So they were out trying to hunt this leopard. And there was the young, I think, son of the family, woke, it was sort of quite late at night, and he woke up and he realized that Sunda's door was open, and he tiptoed out and peeked in the room, and there was no one there. And he thought, where is he? And so he went outside and he looked on from the veranda, and he could see in the moonlight Sunda was sat in a field not so far off, but he was just sat there praying. And this young man thought, what, has he forgotten about the leopard? You don't go out at night when there's a leopard on the loose, and particularly one that keeps coming back to this village. But then he thought to call out to him, but just then he froze, because behind Sunda he saw two glowing eyes, and it was the leopard. And the leopard was crouched and almost in that sort of pouncing position. And this leopard was slowly approaching Sunda. And this young man, it's like he tried to call out, but he couldn't. His voice got stuck. He was so scared and he just froze. And he was watching. And then to his shock, Sunda turned around, saw the leopard, and held out his hand to this leopard. And the leopard came up and lay down next to Sunda. And Sunda stroked its head. And this man was so frozen to the spot, he was expecting something horrendous to occur, and the leopard lay by Sunda's side, and this man just stood there and watched. And after a while, Sunda got up, walked back into the house, went into his room, and fell asleep, not knowing that he was being observed this whole time. And the man, this young man, stayed awake all night thinking about who was in his house, this person who could just pat a leopard. So that was another incident that occurred. Now, there were other times like that where things occurred, but what happened, what started to happen, was particularly in the south, that these stories started to spread. And, you know, Sunda used to say, well, you know, I didn't want to be interrupted in my prayer, and a leopard wasn't going to interrupt me. So that's how he kind of saw the situation. Or when there was a time when he healed someone, and people would say, oh, he's a healer, and Sunda would say, no, God healed, I just happened to be there. And so he used to sort of sweep these things aside, but unfortunately, they took hold, and there was almost this kind of celebrity status that came with Sunda. And the popularity of this man just increased, and people flocked to hear him. Even, you know, even the high sort of Hindus who lived in the south, they travelled to hear this man that was being spoken about so much. And all of this ended up in a bit of a sort of maybe a distraction to the gospel. And Sunda soon realised this when he met with a young schoolboy. And the father of this boy had arranged that Sunda meet one-on-one with his young son. And this young boy was so awestruck to sit across the table from Sunda that he just stared like this. And Sunda said, well, do you have any questions? And this young boy couldn't think of anything. And then he blurted out and he said, is it true that you only eat chili powder? And Sunda said, what? No, I eat normal food, just like you. And then the boy said, but is it true that you never wash, but your robe always stays clean? And Sunda said, no, I perspire heaps, I have to wash every day. And one by one, all of these silly ideas that had been spread, he kind of said, no, what? And all of these things became, he realized how much of a distraction these things had become for the sake of the gospel. To another young boy who was listening to his stories, he was a young teenager. And this young teenager said to Sunda, I've read all about your stories about Tibet, and I want to go with you. I want to go through the mountain passes, and I'm going to die as a martyr for Christ in Tibet. I'm going to bring the gospel. And Sunda said to him, you know what? To die for Christ as a martyr is easy. To live for Christ, that's what's hard. And this young man took that to heart. Now, in the south, there were some missionaries who'd been there for 30-odd years. They were an older couple. They were called the Parkers. And this older couple saw what was happening and really took Sundar under their wing, so to speak. And they really cared for him because they saw that he was a young man still, in his mid-20s. And they saw that he had no family, no real connections, and all of this attention and the pressure on him was huge. And so they took him and they treated him as their own son. And Rebecca Parker, the wife, was particularly dear to Sundar. And, you know, Sundar had lost his mother at a critical age. And so he actually, in later years, you know, he would sign off his letters, "Your loving son, Sundar." And he really felt that this older couple was so important to him, particularly in these years. But Rebecca Parker also sort of talked to Sundar about writing down some of his story. Because he wrote these little columns, but she thought, you know, it would be really helpful for people in the South to actually have a book about his life. And so together they wrote, and she wrote it in the Indian language, and she entitled it Sundar Singh, Called of God. And it was about just his conversion and his story and some of the things that he had spoken about. And at the last minute, she thought to herself, well, I might as well do one in English. And so she did an English version. And little did she know that that decision to make an English version would begin the next chapter of his life. In 1918, when he was just 29 years old, he was invited by some Indians who had heard him in the South to go to Singapore. And this was the beginning of Sundar Singh becoming a world figure. People across the world would know him, and he was going to bring the gospel to the world. Now, this was unheard of. Like, for him, you know, he was a pretty simple kid, if you think about it, from the north of India, from a village no one's heard of. And the idea that he would travel the world, well, he couldn't even imagine it. But his first trip was to Singapore, and he found it very difficult. He was put up in expensive hotels. People gave him very expensive gifts. And suddenly a whole new set of distraction and difficulty came his way. You know, he would rather have been hungry and tired and persecuted than to have this temptation of money, fame, and fortune. From Singapore, he spoke, and he had to speak in English. And he'd learnt some English from the South, but it was very difficult for him. But he did it, and he spoke in English. And from there, somebody invited him to Malaysia, and he went to Kuala Lumpur, he went to Penang. And from there, someone invited him to China, and Hudson Taylor's son translated for him in China. And he spoke to small sort of gatherings in China. And then from there, he was invited to Japan. And in Japan, he was very shocked. And there were not very many Christians there. It was only very small meetings. And he could see why there were so few Christians in Japan, because he could see the materialism of that country. And from Japan, he returned to India. This was his first trip. And when he came back to India, he continued his life, and he didn't want to change. And this was the thing. Despite all the expensive gifts, the nice hotels, he still wanted to be very clear and single-minded in his purpose. He didn't change his dress. He continued wearing the robe of a sadhu, which, of course, was very shocking in China, where everyone was dressed in the communist sort of greys and so on. To see someone in a robe, it was quite something. But he kept in his dress. He kept with very little possession. And he wanted to stay true to that because he saw the danger of the material wealth and the distraction that that would cause. So back in India, he just continued his life. He travelled to some villages in the north, and he went back to his home village. It had been some time. And when he went back to his home village, the news got out that he was there, and his father came out and actually sought him out. And when he saw his father, there was something different. His father told him, come to my home. And Sundar came, and in private, his father told him that he'd become a Christian. And this was an answer to prayer. You know, Sunda had really, you know, been very hurt by his family, but had incessantly prayed for his family. And finally, his father had become a Christian. But his father was never open about it. And although he truly did become a believer, he never admitted it outwardly. He was afraid of the impact it would have in his community. So even to his dying day, he never openly confessed to, other than his immediate family, that he'd become a Christian. However, in that time, Sunda was able to share with his father for the first time the things that had happened to him, the things that he'd done. And he talked to his father about the fact that he felt, and it was a strange thing, but he really felt the Lord wanted him to go to England. He had no way of going there. He had no money at all. But his father said, well, let me at least share in your work in some way. And he got the money for the fare and he gave it to Sunda. And so not long after that, Sunda was boarding a ship, because in those days it was ship, and he was boarding a ship. Others were wheeling huge trunks and big suitcases, and Sunda had his New Testament and a small leather bag. And he boarded this ship and he set sail to England. Now, when he got to England, he was shocked by the climate. It was foggy, it was drizzling, it was busy, grey, and there he was in London. And he met with a lot of people. And again, he had to continue his life in a very single-minded way because he was offered a lot of prestige and gifts. I mean, he even had an invite to Buckingham Palace, which, interestingly enough, he turned down because it clashed with a conference. He was invited to Oxford. He was invited to all, you know, the big cathedrals of London. And all of this, he really had to be very clear. He didn't want it to have an effect on him as a person, and he didn't want it to distract him from his purpose, which was to encourage the church and also to bring the gospel to people who had not heard it. Now, one interesting and perhaps a little funny incident that occurred to him in England was there was a foggy morning and he was stood on the side of the road waiting to be picked up by somebody. And as he was stood there, an old lady approached and walked right up to him. And he was a little surprised and she got some letters out and she started to prod him with the letters. And soon he realised that she'd mistaken him for a postbox in his orange robes there on the side of the road. And so, of course, he politely greeted her, and she had a heart attack because she was there trying to post letters into him. So he often told that story, and that's sort of something that he remembers England by. And another occasion was when he was staying with a family, and this family had two small children, and he played with them, and he had some good times with these kids. And the next morning he had to leave quite early, so he left, and the kids later that morning they rushed downstairs, and the boy looked around and then he said, "Where's Jesus? He was here yesterday, he played with me. Where's he gone?" And the parents realised that all that time their two kids had thought that they'd invited Jesus to come and stay because of the robes, the sandals and the beard. It looked like Jesus from the children's books. And all that time those kids had thought they were playing with Jesus. Well, it was a nice thing. From England, he travelled to Paris. And from there, he literally just followed the Lord's leading. Someone would say to him, "Can you come to speak here?" And he would agree, and they would often provide the fare because he had nothing. From there, from Paris, he went to America. From America, he originally was going to go back home, but at last minute, things changed and he came to Australia. And he spoke at St. Andrew's Cathedral, and this is in the 1920s. And he spoke in other places in Sydney, And then from there, from Australia, he travelled to Europe. He went to Germany, to Denmark, to Sweden. He appeared before royalty in the Danish royalty. He appeared before little churches, little gatherings, huge conferences. He was himself before kings and before the common folk. And finally, after many years of travelling and exhausting travelling, speaking from place to place, he came back to India. People used to ask him, because, you know, in the 1920s, people didn't travel so much. So people used to ask him, what is your view? You know, you've travelled all these places. How do you see Christians across the world? And he said, in England, the people don't believe in miracles. They have many doubts. They don't believe it. They always look for another reason, a more sort of scientific approach. And my answer to that is there is a greater miracle happening in their midst. And that miracle is that despite their materialism, there are yet some spiritual people amongst them. And that's a greater miracle than all these other things. And of America, he said, in the East, we can read the verse, come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. But perhaps for America, we need to change it slightly. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy gold laden, and I will give you rest. That's what he used to say of America. And he also used to talk about how in the East, you know, there is heathenism. Men worship idols. But in the West, there is an even greater heathenism because men worship themselves. And that's how he sort of understood the church across the world. Now, coming back to India, he came back as a world figure, someone who traveled the world, someone who was known everywhere. His name was common, and, you know, many people had read Rebecca Parker's biography. And along with this came the danger of fame, but along with this came the critics. And there were many people who started to write articles about how Sundar Singh was a fake, how the miracles didn't happen, how he'd actually never been to Tibet, how all of those things were just him trying to get a name for himself. And so Sundar had now to deal with all of this as well, people writing lies about him, spreading these articles and so on. And again, the Parkers really supported him in this. And he had to learn to rise above it all and to remember that all of those details, you know, people started saying, you know, did the leopard really lie down next to you, or did it, you know, and all of these details, he said, these things are not important. The important thing is the gospel and that God has the glory. And he would always come back down to that. But it was a very difficult time for him as well. Now, Tibet was always on his mind. And when he returned to India, he was always thinking about, you know, when the traders were coming in, when it was the time of the mountain passes being open, because he always wanted to travel back into Tibet. And unfortunately, though, his health began to fail. He was now in his mid-30s. And his heart was overexerted. And the doctor saw him and pretty much said, you haven't got long to live if you continue with this pace of life. He was overexhausted, his eyes were starting to fail, his lungs were starting to fail, and probably all those early years at the time in Tibet and the exertion of the climbing and the altitude, along with very little sleep through all the years and the pressure on him, had taken a significant toll. He attempted to go into Tibet on one occasion after he came back. But after about 40 miles of walking, he collapsed on the road and he had some sort of internal bleeding and he had to be carried back. He wasn't able to continue. But he really, really wanted to go back. Now, in this interim time when he couldn't do much and he had to just recover, he wrote many books, many of which you can look at today. One of his most famous is At the Master's Feet. He wrote that book. But after this time, when he felt he was significantly recovered enough with his strength, he decided to make this very last trip to Tibet. And he knew that it would probably be his last, simply because it was such a treacherous trip. And also, you know, for every trip into Tibet, he always used to get his affairs in order and tell people that if he didn't come back, you know, they would just, you know, to just know that he'd gone in Tibet. So he got his affairs in order at this point, and he wrote letters to people, and he told them that he would go in April when the traders came. That's when he would leave, and he would leave from this point, and that he would go along the Niti Pass, which was one of the mountain passes, and that after that, you know, that if they hadn't heard from him by the end of July, they were to come and to Simla, where he had been staying, and they were to sort out all the things that needed to be sorted out. So he wrote this letter to his friends, and in April 1929, when he was 39 years old, he set out to Tibet, and he set out with the traders, and the orange-robed figure disappeared into the mountain passes. Now, by almost mid-July, there was no news of him, and his friends started to get concerned. And so two young missionaries decided that they would travel to the place where he said he was going to set off, and they would trace his steps and see if they could hear any news of him. And so they did that, and they traveled along the Niti Pass, and they went into villages and they asked about him, but no one had seen him. There was a friend that he visited, and his house was only 50 yards from the pass. And so they called on this friend and said, "Have you seen him?" This friend had not seen Sundar. And many other people, like even the villagers and stuff, they recognized him because he'd passed there like year after year. No one had seen him. And so these missionary friends were really shocked, but they thought they'd heard in one village that there was an epidemic of cholera. And people had died, many travelers had died, and their bodies had just been thrown into the river. So, you know, one of the missionaries said, well, perhaps that has happened to him. But another one said, well, people would have seen him prior to this village, though. And so then the other, they thought perhaps he'd fallen, because there were so many different ravines and crevices in the rock. He could have fallen, and his body might have been caught on a ledge that was inaccessible. But then again, they were thinking, oh, somebody would have seen it. Somebody would have known it happened. So other people thought that perhaps, just like Enoch, he was taken by the Lord and he was no more. But the fact is that to this day, there's a mystery around his death. He simply disappeared. And nobody actually knows the events that surrounded his death. But I think we can be sure of the manner of his life. And in a letter to Rebecca Parker, the very last letter he wrote, and he left it for her in Simla to be posted later, he signed it off with Acts 20:24. And I think this verse is perhaps the best summary of his life. "But I do not account my life of any value, nor as precious to myself, if only I may finish my course and the ministry that I received from the Lord Jesus to testify to the gospel of the grace of God." And I think that is probably the best summary of Sundar Singh's life. Thank you. Are there any comments, questions, or queries?
What year was it that he...
1929.
Yeah. You know the incident where he was in the well for 3 days, and
yeah,
he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? I guess I believe it would have given him a taste of what Jesus went through on the cross.
Yeah.
And God had to forsake him on the cross,
yes,
because of all the sins he was carrying.
Yes.
And 3 days, Jesus rose.
Yeah. He talked about that. He talked about in his life, there were many other incidents I've left out, but there were times when he understood what it was to be beaten and forsaken and tortured, and that particular time he did relate it to the Lord's death, and he really felt it very keenly. But it had a big impact on him as well, and you know, other people spoke to him about Tibet, and when they wrote that, when that incident came up, he actually was visibly shaky because it really had a strong impact, the horror of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Where does this orange robe come from?
It was just a traditional Indian dress. The orange robe was what the sadhus would wear, so the holy men, and he decided to be a Christian sadhu. So a holy man, as in a man that brings the gospel from town to town. So even now in India, there are sadhus, but they often are people who sort of They often have these massive, really disgusting-looking dreadlocks and really that weird sort of way of life and meditate in crazy positions and all sorts of things. And they're a bit of a tourist attraction in the northern parts of India, I think. But the sadhu was the idea of a man who had renounced the modern way of life.
When he went to Singapore or England, did he preach in English or?
Yeah, all of that time in that sort of world tour, he had to speak in English, and he found it very, very difficult. He talked about it as like he had a fire inside, and it was like there was something stopping the fire coming out because he could think so clearly in his mother tongue, but to then try and get the English out, it was very difficult for him. So he found it very tiring for that reason as well.
Thanks, Michelle.